From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our series on religion and faith. We'll hear from religion scholar Martin Marty. He's editing a 5-volume series on the history of fundamentalism and its impact on politics and culture around the world. Then Randall Balmer, the son of a fundamentalist preacher, discusses his book on evangelicals. And we talk with writer and naturalist Terry Tempest Williams about the collision of faith and politics. Her Mormon family has lived in Utah for 5 generations. In the 1950s, they were downwind of atomic weapons testing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Bright denied Mr. Clinton's request in a 22-page ruling, but the clerk of the court says a trial probably won't be scheduled until 1997 at the earliest. Russian forces in the separatist Republic of Chechnya have renewed their attacks on Grozny, the Chechen capital, the BBC's Robert Parsons reports.
The people of Prigorod, a farming community to the southeast of the Chechen capital, were waking from a night's sleep when the Russian bombers came. There was no warning, just the deafening roar of jet engines instants before the bombs fell, and then the explosions, the violence of which ripped houses apart and gouged massive craters in the frozen earth. The attack came only hours after President Yeltsin had told the Russian people that the warplanes would only be used to strike against strategically important targets. It's a message that's clearly not getting through to his local commanders. Prigorod was one of several villages subjected to bombardment, none of which conceal anything remotely resembling a military target. That could not, however, be said of Argun, which for the moment has become the focus of the Russian storm. The Russians need to take the town, which straddles the last main road out of Grozny, if they are to complete their encirclement of the Chechen capital.
Robert Parsons reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen nearly 26 points to 3,835. The Nasdaq is down almost 4 points at 742. This is NPR. AT&T is seeking to raise some of its rates for items like calling cards and operator-handled calls. The telecommunications firm just got federal approval to increase monthly long-distance rates. The new rate plan would generate $259 million for AT&T. Regional phone firms say AT&T's plan underscores the need for more competition in the industry. All 7 regional phone firms say they'll work together to convince Congress to let them join the long-distance market. Australia is holding urgent talks with China over the continuing problem of Chinese asylum seekers who are arriving in Australia by boat. Almost 900 boat people have arrived in the northern port city of Darwin this year. Trent O'Keefe reports.
4 Chinese boats have arrived in Darwin since late last week, all having departed the South China city of Beihai in early December. The 72 Chinese who've just sailed into Darwin Harbour are now being questioned by immigration officers to determine whether they're eligible for refugee status. So far this year, 871 asylum seekers have arrived in Darwin, and weather permitting, immigration officers believe the influx will continue over coming weeks. These recent arrivals have prompted high-level talks between Australian and Chinese diplomats in both Canberra and Beijing. It's believed the asylum seekers fled Beihai after their homes were demolished to make way for redevelopment. For National Public Radio, this is Trent O'Keefe in Darwin.
Striking baseball players say they'll let Baltimore Orioles shortstop Cal Ripken cross picket lines to keep a playing streak alive. Ripken is closing in on the record of most games played consecutively. He's played in 2,009 games straight. He's 122 games shy of Lou Gehrig's record. The players' union has told Ripken he can take the field with strike breakers if team owners bring in replacement players in 1995. But the owner of Ripken's team, Peter Angelos, says he'll fight other owners before he'll accept replacement players. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're featuring a series of interviews from our archives on religion and faith. Fundamentalism is changing the shape of religion around the world. It's also changing politics and culture. My guest, Martin Marty, is editing a 5-volume series called The Fundamentalism Project, examining the global history of fundamentalism and its social and political impact. Four of the volumes have already been published. The final one is due out next fall. Marty is one of America's foremost religion scholars. He's a distinguished professor at the Divinity School of the University of Chicago and the author of many books, including Modern American Religion. I spoke with Martin Marty in 1992 about his study of fundamentalism.
I think that 30 years ago or 40 years ago when I started writing on this topic, most of us thought that fundamentalism had had it. We knew that it still had some radio stations down on the Texas-Mexico border, and we knew that in Tennessee people did very strange things on the other side of the hollow, but most people in the mainline culture dismissed it. And it overtook us. All of a sudden we realized that to the right of the genteel evangelicals like Billy Graham were people who had very threatened and sometimes ominous views of where the world was going, where the culture was going, how to rescue people out of it. And in the 1970s, we learned they had some plans for trying to change the culture.
As someone who appreciates pluralism, how welcoming are you of fundamentalist religions which sometimes don't recognize the validity of other religions or other points of view?
You're right. I do celebrate pluralism, partly because I think it's the only option we have. If we want a society which welcomes immigrants and welcomes personal freedom, and if you have people like me who welcome community and identity and trust and all that, then you have to make room for all kinds of people that you wouldn't naturally feel at home with. So if you ask me, would I like my daughter to marry one? No, I'm nervous about fundamentalists up close. Do I agree with their program? Very seldom. Do I welcome their passion? I do think they have enlivened American life somewhat, but I have to begin on the assumption that the pluralism means any number can play, and even if they would change the rules of the game if they won, so might some other people. I'm very much a devotee of James Madison, and I think that when somebody comes along that you disagree with, you don't rule them out, you counter-organize, and you form new coalitions, and I think that's a much healthier thing for Americans to do than to say, drive them out.
The first volume of your five-volume fundamentalist project looks at the rise of fundamentalism around the world, Christians, Jews, Muslims. What are some of the characteristics that you think fundamentalists in different religions have in common?
That's a good question, because some people think that if you do some comparing, you mean that everything is alike, and fundamentalisms are extremely different from each other as far as the content is concerned. Christian doctrine differs from Jewish story, differs from Islamic law. So they're very different. But what do they have in common? They are all modern, dynamic. They're not conservative the way we thought they were. They're not traditional the way we thought they were. The Amish are conservative and Orthodox Jews are traditional, but they're not fundamentalists. Fundamentalists are people who, when they feel threatened by modernity, by change, by pluralism, the word you brought up, by relativism, by strangers and enemies and neighbors that they don't understand, they fight back. And they use things they call fundamentals to fight back. They'll improvise, they'll change these fundamentals constantly to face whatever the threat might be. The threat might be the great Satan of the United States, if you're in parts of the Middle East. It might be secular humanism, if you're an American fundamentalist. But something they're concerned about is going to overwhelm them, they think, unless they fight back.
So you think the fundamentalists aren't traditional or conservative. In fact, they're militant.
We made the mistake of thinking that they were conservative. Conservatives mainly want to be left alone. Traditionalists mainly want to live as if their ancestors were getting the main number of votes, drive past the Amish community, let the Orthodox walk to their temple. They won't hand you a tract. They won't try to convert you. They won't head to the state legislature to try to get a change in the laws. If they violate laws, the ACLU or somebody else has to come along to defend them. They won't even defend themselves. They just want the world to be the way it was with their foreparents. Fundamentalists aren't that. They have the latest techniques. The Ayatollah Khomeini used cassette recorders, and in Egypt they use transistor radios. In America they use television and rapid mails. They want to be in the thick of things, and if they don't like the way things are going, they'll change. Now, you use the word militant, and I suppose that scares some people, because militant in many parts of the world means Sikhs killing Hindus, killing Muslims, killing Jews, or Protestants and Catholics killing each other in Northern Ireland. That's what militant usually means. Militant might just mean highly vocal, highly aggressive. Some of the abortion fronts in America that block clinics and so on are self-described fundamentalists, and they're militant, but I think they just as soon not kill anybody along the way.
Do you think it's any coincidence that fundamentalism within different religions is on the rise?
I don't think it's coincidence so much as common response to common threat. For example, traditionalists and conservatives could be left alone until mass media came. But the moment television can intrude in any Iranian village, the moment U.S. cinema can be shown in Jerusalem on a Friday night of the Sabbath too near the Haredim or some other group that don't want this to happen, they have to respond. So I think the shrinking of the globe is part, the fact that markets bump into each other, the fact of mass media, mass higher education, anything which means that the forces that you don't like can't be kept away is what occasions a fundamentalist response. The other thing that I think that is a very big factor is fundamentalists have good antennae. They read well. They have good instincts. And they sense that certain things that the rest of us try to cope with will overwhelm them. For example, in America, the Roe v. Wade decision on abortion or the two school prayer decisions of 1962 to 63, they perceived as the government intruding on their way of life, the government allowing the killing of babies, the government pushing God out of the schools. They'll take these kinds of acts, and I think they think that once upon a time, they could have been sheltered from them. You could always control your local school. You could always control your local clinic. But now the big forces of bureaucracy and so on are hitting at them. Well, I don't think you have to be a fundamentalist to say that we are much more webbed together and that decisions made at a great distance affect us. So since they feel that, whether in Iran or India or Ireland or anywhere else, they're going to respond the same way.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Martin Marty. He's a religion scholar who's editing a five-volume series called The Fundamentalism Project. The first volume has just been published. American fundamentalists, American Christian fundamentalists, offer themselves as protectors of traditional values in terms of the religion, a family, social values. But isn't the religion really pretty recent, early 20th century? And is that a contradiction?
Well, I think that most fundamentalists choose their past. Other people think they're merely being conservative, so that an American Protestant fundamentalist will tend to choose the biblical period, the time when Jesus is alive, and they'll create a picture of what they thought it was like, and so they'll defend the traditional family in the name of it. Well, one thing you have to say, and I have to say as a believer in the Gospels, the Gospel picture of Jesus is not very close to what today's pro-family people claim. Jesus was quite critical of his mother. His brothers and sisters didn't like him and didn't recognize him. Somebody wanted to bury his father, and he said, "Let the dead bury their own dead." At one time he says, according to the Gospel portrait, you have to hate father and mother or for the sake of the kingdom. Now, we all know that's only a little part of the portrait of Jesus, who has the image, I think rightfully, of being an instrument of love and not of division. But the Gospels show him putting the price very high and quite destructive of the kind of family that's here. But the fundamentalists will choose the family from, as your question implied, I think, the late 19th century and say, that's how it always has been. My colleague and associate in this venture, Scott Appleby, is an expert on Roman Catholicism. Roman Catholics who are not exactly fundamentalist, I guess we'd say fundamentalist-like, they're not defending the Bible so much as they're defending the 19th century papacy, infallibility, and things like that.
So when you say that a lot of fundamentalists are really defending 19th century values and offering 19th century values as tradition, is that because that was the set of values that they were most nostalgic for when they started fundamentalism at the turn of the 20th century?
That's very close to it, because at the turn of the 20th century, two kinds of things hit. One, modern technology. They choose the late 19th century, or maybe even the 1920s yet. They have a kind of a Norman Rockwell image of a safe and cozy village America. Was the last possible moment before the change came, and their great-grandparents could still tell them about it. I think that's the one reason. The other reason is some dimensions of modern thought triggered fundamentalism. And here it isn't hard to be empathic with them to understand what a threat it was. In America, in Protestantism, the two threats were evolution, which swept the universities and colleges and academic centers and gave a different accounting of human origins, and biblical criticism, which was just the word for saying that scholars applied scientific tools of history and literary criticism to the Bible the way they would to Shakespeare or Homer or Dante. And the Bible was to be seen in their world as a completely protected book with its own rules of the game. So when those two things came along, technology and these changes in idea patterns, they felt potentially overwhelmed. Everything they stood for would be undercut.
Many fundamentalists reject modernity and reject social change and changes in values. On the other hand, there's parts of modernity that they embrace, like TV. I mean, fundamentalists in America have probably made the best use of broadcasting of any religion. Do you see that as a contradiction?
Again, your questions are right to the target of what we're working on in this project. And that's why I began with what was designed, I think, to be a little upsetting sounding, to say fundamentalists are not fundamental and they're not historic and traditional conservative. They are modern, but your question has it right. They are selectively modern. On one level, they will pick a presumed past of doctrines, of stories, of laws to go back to. And on the other hand, you're right, technology is there. It's amazing how worldly a lot of fundamentalists are in America. They want to succeed on general terms. The best known of the fundamentalists, Jerry Falwell, not as well known as he was 12 years ago, but he's still big with his Liberty University in Virginia, always defines it in terms that are, as soon as we're as powerful that we can knock Notre Dame butts on the football field or Mormon butts at Brigham Young, well, these are very worldly ways of counting status and prestige and power. It's kind of a pro-Miss America, pro-National Football League, pro-success kind of thing, which is compatible, in their view, with their doctrines. So you're right. It's a very selective view of what you accept and reject. And this may change from year to year. A few years ago, all fundamentalists said that all rock music was evil because the beat was from Satan. It moved pelvises the wrong way and so on. A few years later, I think some of them, not all of them, but some of them saw their own teenagers being lured, and they come up with Christian rock, which has Jesus' words in it, but it still has the same pelvic beat. I consider them very smart to do that. It's very inconsistent if they were traditionalist.
Did fundamentalism in America start in the South?
No, fundamentalism in America started in the North, but found its natural congenial home in the South. The South was traditional and conservative. The fundamentalists only took over the Southern Baptist Convention in the last 10 years or so. Southern Baptists were always conservative and traditional, but they weren't reactive and they weren't trying to pass laws for the whole country the same way.
The American Academy of Arts and Sciences asked you to do the five-volume fundamentalism project. They're interested in finding out what implications there will be of fundamentalism for public policy formulation. I'm wondering if you have any ideas of how the history of fundamentalism and the resurgence of fundamentalism might affect public policy.
Well, I have many kinds of ideas. We ourselves, as scholars, don't take sides in any of these things. But it would be, I think, very foolish for people not to pay attention to the military implications of fundamentalism, the economic, dealing with parts of the world where Islam, in its fundamentalist form, has influence on economy, is going to affect American economy. And domestically, public policy implications. I always tell people my main public policy implication is to make a great deal of James Madison and the U.S. Constitution and the Federalist Papers, namely, keep our pluralism rich and alive. Don't go reaching for laws that say, let's rule out the fundamentalists, but get our own acts together if we don't agree with them to head them off. I think that such groups have made some gains. I think fundamentalists were getting a free ride in some of the courts and some of the textbook publishing world with some of their programs a dozen years ago, and they find it somewhat harder now. Some reviews of our book, I think, in effect, will say, of all of our books, will say, you scholars are so fair to the fundamentalists, or fair-minded, or empathic, I used that word a couple times, or whatever, that you make them all sound so nice that we'll all go to sleep. Some fundamentalists read it and say, you're alarmist. I guess as long as it comes from both those directions, we'll have a sense that we are presenting materials that'll be useful to the very broad parts of the culture.
Well, Martin Marty, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I enjoyed the opportunity. Thank you.
Martin Marty is the editor of the Fundamentalism Project, a five-volume series. Four of those books have already been published by the University of Chicago Press. We spoke in 1992. We'll hear from Randall Balmer, author of a book about evangelicalism, after this break. This is Fresh Air. Randall Balmer is the author of what he describes as a travelogue into the evangelical subculture in America. He says he wrote his book neither to vilify nor to vindicate American evangelicalism, but to better understand it. His book, Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory, was the companion text to a public TV series of the same name. His travels took him to a megachurch in California with roots in the Jesus movement of the early 70s, a Bible Institute in Portland, a Billy Graham crusade in Central Park, a Pentecostal congregation in Georgia, and a camp meeting in Florida. Balmer's father is a fundamentalist preacher, but Randall Balmer left fundamentalism when he went to college. He now teaches American religious history at Barnard College. I spoke with him in 1993, and he told me he's reached the conclusion that people like him who are raised in fundamentalist families often don't experience the powerful conversion that people raised outside the fold do.
That realization came to me actually in the course of writing the book, visiting a Bible camp up in upstate New York in the Adirondack Mountains called Word of Life. I began to see myself for the first time, began to recognize the kind of struggles that I had gone through as an adolescent as I was watching other adolescents do that. I think it's very difficult for the children of evangelical parents to claim the faith for their own, because evangelicalism demands or expects a kind of dramatic conversion experience. They wouldn't always say that they demand that, but I think more often than not there is that expectation that your conversion will be dramatic. But if you have been socialized in the church, in Sunday school, vacation Bible school, Bible camp all of your life, then at a, say, early adolescence, you're asked to have this conversion experience, it really doesn't have much power over you because all you're doing is simply ratifying the lifestyle that you've been taught all along. And I think it's very difficult for children of evangelical parents to appropriate the faith, or at least the fervency of the faith that they think they should.
Did you have a conversion or a born-again experience?
I did, but again, it lacked the power that I thought it should have. And so I went through this whole series, which I think is very, very familiar and even predictable with evangelical kids, where you have that initial conversion experience, but then you have subsequent experiences that they call rededication. I'm rededicating my life to Christ. And I think what's happening in that instance is that the kids are saying, it didn't really take the first time because I didn't hear bells and whistles, and it didn't grip me as I think it should have. And so I'm going to try again and again and again. And I think finally many adolescents, and I think myself included, begin to throw up their arms and abandon the faith in despair.
In your book, Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory, you write that one of the reasons why you wanted to travel around the country looking at different evangelical churches and different evangelical preachers was that you wanted to reacquaint yourself with the revolutionary force of the evangelical gospel. What is that force?
I think the message of the New Testament is that humanity is in need of divine intervention. And through Jesus, we are given access to the grace of God, and God's grace is ineluctable. That is, it cannot be resisted. That, to me, I think, is the force of evangelicalism. It seems to me there are two elements in Martin Luther's rediscovery of the gospel in the 16th century. The first is that human nature is depraved and in need of salvation. The second is that God offers God's grace unconditionally. And it seems to me the great divide you see in American Protestantism in the 20th century between the liberals on the one hand, that is mainline Protestants, and evangelicals or fundamentalists on the other side, is that each side has not upheld both elements of that gospel. That is, the liberals emphasize God's grace without taking into account human depravity. The evangelicals emphasize human depravity without taking fully into account God's grace. And that, to me, is the tragedy of 20th century Protestantism.
You described your trip around America as a personal odyssey. Were you, and you say you were, or you expected to be changed by it. How were you changed?
I was changed in that a lot of the preaching I heard, and especially the music that I heard, was evocative of my own past. I began to be rather nostalgic about my own past, the kind of simplicity of the religion that I was reared with. And in many ways, I missed that. The complexity of life and intellectual doubts that I've acquired over the years can sometimes be disconcerting. And so in that sense, I was changed. I was also changed, I think, by the people that I met. Again, I wanted to write the book to get away from this notion that the televangelists somehow equal evangelicals in America. That, I knew, as someone who grew up as an evangelical, was absolutely wrong. And so, in the course of my travels, I became acquainted with hundreds of people who are salt-of-the-earth sort of people, people that you would love to have as neighbors, even though you might regard their views or their theology as a bit peculiar. They're wonderful people. And I was impressed by that again and again. These are the people whose faith really has sustained them during hard times, people with a lot of medical problems and illness, who are utterly convinced that God somehow has gotten them through the difficult times in their lives. And these are the people that I think changed me in many ways.
Randall Balmer is the author of Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory. He teaches American religious history at Barnard College. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our series on religion and faith with writer and naturalist Terry Tempest Williams. For five generations, her Mormon family has lived in Utah, but their way of life was tested when seven women in her family died from cancer. Williams blames the cancer on atomic testing downwind of their home. Williams discusses what happens when politics and faith are at odds, coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House says CIA Director James Woolsey has resigned. The surprise announcement was made by President Clinton, who says he's accepted Woolsey's resignation with regret. Woolsey has been criticized for his handling of the Aldrich Ames spy case, but the president's statement praises Woolsey for helping transform American intelligence in the aftermath of the Cold War. Zapatista rebels in the southern Mexican state of Chiapas have accepted the government's plan to restart peace talks. NPR's David Wellna reports from Mexico City.
In a communique published today, the Zapatistas say they recognize Mexico's Secretary of Governance as the representative of the executive branch in efforts to get peace talks underway. The rebels had earlier rejected a group of legislators from various factions, including the ruling party, as mediators in the year-old conflict. The government, for its part, has yielded to the Zapatistas' demands that a group of civilians sympathetic to their cause act as a go-between. That group is headed by the controversial Bishop of San Cristobal, Samuel Ruiz. The elderly diabetic prelate has eaten nothing for the last 9 days to call attention to the danger of renewed warfare in Chiapas. Thousands of government troops have moved into the region since the Zapatistas renewed their insurgency last week. No shots have yet been fired, but a buffer zone between the two sides has now disappeared. I'm David Wellman, Mexico City.
The Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta has asked the National Park Service to vacate the King Center property by tonight. The move would end a 14-year-old relationship. From Peach State Public Radio in Atlanta, Susanna Capelluto reports.
The National Park Service runs tours of King's birth home and the sites surrounding the tomb. Now they want to build an $11 million visitor center honoring Dr. King across the street from the King Center. The King family, however, wants to build its own museum. After the two sides failed to reach a compromise, the King family asked the Park Service to leave their property. But Park Superintendent Troy Lissamore says he hopes they won't have to leave tonight.
But our commitment is to the public, and we, in our position as public servants, that's what we want to do, to continue serving the public that has an interest in Dr. King. We're not trying to take over.
The Park Service has asked Congressman John Lewis to mediate in the dispute. For National Public Radio, I'm Susanna Capelluto in Atlanta.
President Clinton says there's no reason for North Korea to keep on holding downed pilot Bobby Hall. He's rejecting North Korean claims that Hall is a spy. Mr. Clinton has sent envoys to Pyongyang to work toward Hall's release. The pilot has been held since December 19th when his chopper flew into North Korean airspace and was downed. His co-pilot, David Heilman, was killed. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today. The Dow lost 22 points to end at 3,839. This is NPR. Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozarev says Moscow will use all force necessary to end the crisis in Chechnya. Kozarev backs President Boris Yeltsin's hard line on the separatist region, but he says Moscow is willing to hold talks with the Chechens to settle the violence. The Chechen government has rejected conditions that Yeltsin laid down for talks to start, so the fighting continues. Journalism is still a dangerous job. According to the International Federation of Journalists, some 115 journalists have been killed covering stories in 1994. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
The 115 deaths represent a grim new record. A further 15 are under investigation. According to the Federation's General Secretary Aidan White, it was a year of media slaughter on an unprecedented scale. The report says that intense competition among news organizations to be first with stories was leading to dangerous exploitation of journalists. Rwanda was the most dangerous place to report from. 48 Rwandan journalists were victims of the tribal slaughter there. The next most dangerous spot was Algeria, where 19 members of the press have died, most at the hands of Islamic militants. 7 journalists were killed in Bosnia, down from 13 last year. The latest confirmed death was that of an American. Photographer Cynthia Elbaum was killed last week, covering the conflict in the breakaway Russian Republic of Chechnya. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
The creator of a controversial new bullet has promised to delay the ammunition's release. David Keene told NBC today he's decided to put his new bullet, called Black Rhino, on hold, even if it's approved by federal authorities. Keene says there's a real fear that these bullets could reach criminals. The Black Rhino is supposed to be able to pierce body armor like the bulletproof vests worn by police officers. Several lawmakers say they'll try to have the new ammunition banned. The NRA says reports of the ammunition seem like a hoax. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We continue our religion series with writer and naturalist Terry Tempest Williams. Her memoir, Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place, is a book about family, the natural world, faith, and politics. Williams is a fifth-generation Mormon. She lives in Utah near the Great Salt Lake. She writes, "Most statistics tell us breast cancer is genetic. What they don't say is that living in Utah may be the greatest hazard of all." Williams' family lived downwind from atomic bomb tests. Her mother, her grandmothers, and six aunts have had mastectomies. Williams has had two biopsies for breast cancer and a small tumor between her ribs diagnosed as a borderline malignancy. Her mother died of ovarian cancer years after her bout with breast cancer. Six other women in the family died of cancer. In 1992, Terry Tempest Williams told me about a recurring dream she used to have about a flash of light.
I did have this recurring dream of this flash of light in the night in the desert, and I had it over and over and over. And one night my father and I were having dinner, and I said, "You know, it's the strangest thing. I keep having this recurring dream." And I explained it to him, and he looked at me very matter-of-factly and said, "You did see it." And I said, "Saw what?" And he said, "The bomb. The cloud." I remember the day. We were coming home from California, September 7th, 1957. You were sitting on your mother's lap. She was pregnant. And it was a few hours before dawn. We saw this explosion. I thought the oil tanker in front of us had blown up. We pulled over. And suddenly rising out of the desert was this golden-stemmed cloud, the mushroom. And he said there was this eerie pink glow. And within seconds, suddenly there was this light ash raining on the car. I was stunned. And he looked at me and he said, "I thought you knew that. It was a common occurrence in the 50s. And I think it was at that moment I realized the deceit I had been living with, that all of us of this generation had been living with, growing up in the American Southwest, drinking contaminated milk from contaminated cows. And as I say, even the breasts of our mothers, members years later of the clan of one-breasted women. I had no idea, Terry."
Do you know which blast this was that you had witnessed unknowingly?
It was. I do. And I actually researched it to find out if that date was accurate. And it was. It was Operation Plum Bob, one of the most extensive tests to ever be enlisted during that time in the 1950s through 1962.
I guess it's amazing to me that your family would have been driving along through the desert, see a nuclear bomb explosion, and not talk about it all the time afterwards.
Isn't that, to me that just shows that was the myth and the time we were living through. And when you talk to people who live in St. George, it was entertainment. I mean, they would climb to a particular ridge, and a few hours before dawn, they would watch the nuclear bomb as though it were fireworks, sitting on top of high schools, lovers that would go park. I mean, the stories are endless of the days when you could really watch that phenomenon with no knowledge of what it was really doing to them.
Seven women in your family have died of breast cancer.
Yes.
You've had two biopsies yourself.
Yes.
Do you think it's connected to the nuclear bomb tests?
I can't prove that it is, but I can't prove that it isn't. And when you look at the statistics in Utah of those individuals who have died of cancer after 1960, I have no doubt in my mind. And I look at those of my generation, you look at the obituaries in Utah, and it is daily. I think we were used by our government, and when the Atomic Energy Commission said it is virtually uninhabited desert terrain, my family, my generation, were some of the virtual uninhabitants.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Terry Tempest Williams, and her new book is called Refuge, in a Natural History of Family and Place. When your mother was dying, she thought of death in a very spiritual sense and of course, didn't think of her illness politically at all. On the eve of her surgery, she asked your grandmother, who had also been through breast surgery, what to expect. What did your grandmother tell her?
I remember I was 15 years old at the time, and my grandmother was staying with us that night. I have three younger brothers, the youngest being four. The telephone rang. I picked it up at the same time my grandmother did, and my mother said, "What can I expect?" My grandmother had also had a mastectomy, and she said, "Diane, it's one of the most spiritual experiences you will ever encounter."
And when your mother came out of surgery, that proved to be true for her. What did she tell you?
We met her in the lobby of the hospital, and I remember her radiance. And she said, "Children, I want you to know I have felt the arms of God around me." And we believed her. My father cried, and we believed her. And at that time, she was 38 years old.
How old are you now?
I'm 37.
So what did it mean to you when she said that? Was that comforting?
You have to understand, you know, we were, at that time, I was a very devout Mormon. That was how we had been raised. My grandmother had had cancer. My aunt had had cancer. It was a fact of life. So it was both horrifying to me because suddenly the thought of not having a mother was terrifying. It was as though this plastic dome of safety had shattered. And yet as I looked into her eyes and I saw her peace and calm, I think my impression, Terry, was there is something here I don't understand. And it was more about listening.
We're featuring a 1992 interview with writer and naturalist Terry Tempest Williams. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Terry Tempest Williams, author of the memoir Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place. In your book, you write that in Mormon culture, authority is respected, obedience is revered, and independent thinking is not. Through your mother's death and through your knowledge soon after that of your exposure to nuclear bomb tests, you had this kind of like dual sense of death and illness. One is a kind of spiritual understanding that it can be a kind of transcendent experience to go through with an open mind and an open heart and everything, the kind of suffering of death. But at the same time, you're starting to think that there were political reasons why your mother was going through the suffering, and it had to do with the exposure to radiation. What kind of challenge did that present to your sense of faith, which, as you say, wasn't about questioning authority? And that's exactly what you started to do after your mother died, was question the authority of the government who decided to have these bomb blasts not too far from where people were living.
It gave me a focus, because I think there's a lot of anger that comes when you watch someone suffer, whether you acknowledge it or not. And when I realized that it may have, in fact, been because of our government's lying and the above-ground testing, suddenly I wanted to know everything about that. And so it really directed my energy in a very concrete way. And I made a decision to go down to the test site to see for myself what was there, and ultimately to make the decision to commit civil disobedience, which I did. I must say, there were foreshadowings along the way. I remember a year prior to Mother's death, Mother and my grandmother and I were in St. George, and we were there when the Great Peace March came through, and we actually joined them for maybe a half a mile, and it was the first time I had ever heard my mother or grandmother sing outside of church. And I remember that morning we were going to go out birdwatching in a place called Beaver Dam Wash, but we had heard over the radio that night that there was going to be another nuclear test. And we made the decision not to go because of the venting that occurs. So it was almost like subconsciously we knew we were part of this story, and yet consciously we'd never spoke of it. And yet here we were marching a year before, and a year later I was arrested. And after being released in Nevada, I met my grandmother in St. George. And I will never forget her opening the door and putting her arms around me and just sobbing, saying, "Thank you, what you've done for all of us." And then my uncle, who was a vet from World War II, walking out of the room.
In anger?
Yes.
What was he angry about?
Our family is a very staunch Republican Mormon family. And for him, it was an outrage. It was the ultimate act of of betrayal.
Have you been able to keep your Mormon faith and challenge authority at the same time?
I think I take my cue from Octavio Paz when he says that revolution requires both love and criticism. So there are many aspects of the Mormon culture that I love, that notion of family, community, and there are other aspects that I find extremely problematic with the patriarchy. So it's a difficult question and it's a complicated answer. And all I can tell you is that for now I've chosen to remain inside the church with a voice, but I think at some personal cost.
Have you been criticized by people in the church?
Yes.
But not excommunicated?
Not excommunicated.
You're a fifth-generation Mormon. Is it very important to you to keep in that tradition? Because it means, not only means keeping the faith, it means keeping a family tradition.
It's all about family. It really is. And my family's all in Utah. And my ancestors' bones are buried there. And I think as long as you can keep a sense of humor, and as I say, keep pushing the boundaries, that's my life. That's where I come from. And it certainly is not perfect, but it really is what gives me sustenance and strength. And particularly in the American West, I mean, the Mormon people came to Utah for religious sovereignty. And I think they have an enormous sense of place and community. And I think there's a great deal to learn from Mormon culture and history. But I also think there's a great deal to contend with and to question and to provoke.
My guest is Terry Tempest Williams, author of the memoir Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. We're going to have news today of the resignation of James Woolsey as Director of Central Intelligence. That announcement made today by President Clinton at the White House. Also, a new appointment named to the Department of Agriculture. Defeated Kansas Democratic Congressman Dan Glickman will be the next Secretary of Agriculture if he's confirmed by the Senate. Also on today's program, Ann Garrels reports from a children's hospital in Russia, where a team of American burn doctors are working with children, and they're working against the conditions typical of many Russian hospitals.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is writer and naturalist Terry Tempest Williams. I'm going to ask you to read a section of your book it's a very moving passage that's really a journal entry, I believe. And this is about the day that your mother died and spending those last moments of her life with her. Would that be okay to read?
Yes. I'm going to be reading from my journal entry, Friday, January 16th, 1987. Walking into her room, I could see death was imminent, and I was surprised to see the physical changes from the night before. Her color had changed, especially around the mouth and nose. Her face was waxen, her feet were cold. It was as though dying moves from your toes upward. Mother's breathing was regular, but strained as she exhaled. So much going out, so little coming in. I knelt at the foot of her bed with the soles of her feet pressed against my forehead. It was the only place I could feel her pulse. I rubbed her legs under the mohair blanket. They were like ice. Dad paced the room, occasionally sitting next to her to hold her hand. We took turns. From 1 until 4 in the afternoon, we sat near her, a meditation. Her breaths could now be heard as moans. Her eyes were haunting, open, and clear. Time was suspended like watching a fire. Gradually, Mother's breaths became a mantra, and the death mask we feared was removed. My father spoke of what it had meant to him to take care of our own. In these hours, we began to realize the magnitude of these past weeks, months, years. Talk of everyday life crept in, basketball scores, the day's news, even laughter, and there, Mother lay, dying. I never doubted her presence. The light in the room deepened. It occurred to me that Mother would wait until after sunset, and it was an exquisite one. An apricot aura radiated above the purple ochre range. I told Mother what a beautiful sunset it was. I recalled her applause on another afternoon. We turned a small lamp on. Mother's color looked better, and for a moment we believed she would never die. The belabored breathing continued. We took turns holding her hands, rubbing her forehead, moistening her mouth, and we could feel the cold moving up her body. Her head was turned now, and with each breath her head drew back, reminding me of the swallow I beheld at Bear River, moments before it died. Dad began to get nervous. He worried that Mother could go on for a few more days, that we had kept vigil too many times. He smiled with an anxious grin, saying, "Diane, you may outlast me yet." Our eyes met, death eyes. I looked into them, eyes wide with knowledge, unblinking, objective eyes, eyes detached from the soul, eyes turned inward. I moved from the chaise across the room and sat cross-legged on the bed next to her. I took her right hand in mine and whispered, "Okay, Mother, let's do it." I began breathing with her. It began simply as a mirroring of her breath, taking the exertion of her exhale, ah, and reflecting back a more peaceful expression. Ah, Mother and I became one, one breathing organism. Everything we had ever shared in our lives manifested itself in this moment, in each breath, here and now. I was stunned by the way her eyes fixed on mine, the duet we were engaged in. At other times, I just closed my eyes and merged with her, whispering once again, "Let go, Mother, let go." But mostly, it was just breath, slowing down, quieting down, until only the sweetest, faintest expressions of breath remained. Eric Fromm writes, "The whole life of the individual is nothing but the process of giving birth to himself. Indeed, we should fully be born when we die." A full moon hung in a starlit sky. It was Mother's face illumined.
That's a really beautiful passage, and I thank you for reading it. I know when you wrote this book, one of the things you did was show it to the members of your family and ask them to help you edit it. I think that's a very kind of gracious, generous thing to do when you're writing about people and about their lives. What kind of knowledge about each other came out of that? Do you know what I mean? About showing them your book in which you wrote about your mother and her death and your thoughts about other people in the family.
I think it provoked a great deal of discussion. I think we are not accustomed to death. We don't have that opportunity to be with death. And I think because our family had two chances, the first chance in 1971 when Mother had breast cancer, we shied away from it. We did not do well. The second time, I think it was a very conscious decision as a family that we wanted to face this with Mother head on. And we did the best we could, having no idea what territory we were entering. And I think we were all very raw after that experience. I felt that it was only fair if I was telling this story that my family be part of it and that they have veto power of those things that they were not comfortable with. And there's a very fine line between what is personal and what is private. And I think the most powerful aspects of this story in Refuge were the ones I did not tell. What did it reveal of my family's character? I remember giving my father the first draft as I was heading on a plane for New York to give it to my editor as well. When I got to the hotel, the red light was flashing. I called my father. He was outraged, saying he couldn't believe what I had told, that he looked like a hothead. You know, he was furious about the fact that I had mentioned he had cried. What would his men think who worked for him? And then he said, "And then your brother would like to talk to you." And my brother got on the phone, and I said, "And?" And he said, "I can't believe what a minor character I am." So I think we all had our issues to deal with. But I think in the end, my family realized this was my story, and the story that they would have to tell would be very different. But I think as a family, we emerged with a sense of wholeness, a sense that each day is a gift and that we must live our lives with unguarded hearts. And that also a revolutionary character is essential to our own survival. That blind obedience in the name of patriotism or religion ultimately takes our lives. And I think our family, having gone through this experience of watching the women around us die slow, heroic deaths, has made us much more fierce and much more compassionate, with that notion that grief does dare us to love once more, and it is a love that is wild.
Could you ever imagine yourself moving away from Utah?
Terry, I can't. I really love Utah. It's my home. I am deeply committed to it. I think it's about residency. And it's about really digging in. I mean, sometimes I think the most radical act we can commit is to stay home, because then we can be mindful of the changes that are occurring. And we have a voice, and we know the myths, and we know the language, and we know the stories.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Terry Tempest Williams recorded in 1992 after the publication of her memoir, Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place. Her latest book is called An Unspoken Hunger. Our series on religion and faith concludes tomorrow. Our religion series was produced by Danny Miller. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts, and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, preaching the gospel in word, deed, and music. Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood tells us how he revived a dying church in one of Brooklyn's poorest neighborhoods. And we hear from gospel saxophonist Bernard Johnson as our religion series concludes. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.